I'm going to talk about the gravitational micro-lensing experiment done by the EROS group and the interpretation of the data toward the spiral arms. First, let me give a brief introduction to gravitational lensing. What's the gravitational lensing? Is the bending of the light passing by a massive object and curves the space-time, and then light goes through the geodesics. And so this is a very simple configuration of the lensing. Here we have the observer, here we have lens, and this is the source. In the absence of the lens, light travels this path. And if you put the lens here from the Schwarzschild metric, this will be the deflection angle. And from the geometry here, we can obtain the position of the images from the position of the source and the lens. However, we can obtain the lens equations from the Fermat principle. This is the Fermat potential, composed by the two terms of the geometrical term and the gravitational term. And if we in the stationary point, this gives us the position of the images. And if we put here the geometrical term and the gravitational term here, the Fermat potential will be this term. Theta is the position of the image, beta is the position of the source, and this is a two-dimensional gravitational potential. So the position of the image in the Fermat potential will be the minimum, maximum, and saddle point in this potential. And the first derivative of the potential gives us the lens equation that we can directly get from the geometrical configuration from the previous slide. Now we want to see how the source transfers the image position. And we want to see that how the differential element in the lens, in the source position, goes to the image position. If we obtain the Jacobian of the transformation, then we can see I will use this as a demonstration. we can get the differential element in the image position, in the source position, to the image. And the ratio of these two area gives us how the image extended, and also if we have a point source, I will show that this gives us a magnification of the light. So the inverse of the Jacobian gives us a magnification of the light in the point in the case of point source. So here is the if you take the bottom part of the wine glass, the light reflection in this area is very similar to the gravitational lens. So we can use this glass as a tool for gravitational lensing experiment. And here, if we move a ball from behind this lens, behind this glass, you see that? Okay, this is a lens. And we will see the ring here, which is called Einstein ring, when the observer, lens, and source are in the straight line. So in the case of cosmological scale, we can see gravitational lensing, and this is a cluster of galaxy and lens, the structures at the background, and we see the arcs here due to the lensing. And also, in some cases, the shape of the galaxies is deformed. It's called the weak lensing. And in the case that we have multiple images, we have strong lens. So I'm going to talk about lensing of a star by another star inside the Milky Way. So unlike the cosmological scale, where the source lens and observer doesn't move during our lifetime. In the Milky Way, we can see that all this point, T-point, change by time in the order of 1 month. So we can see the lensing effect in the order of 1 month. We can see that background start getting brighter and then dimmer, and this is due to the gravitational lens. But the problem with the gravitational lensing inside the Milky Way is that the angular separation between the images are really small. It's in the order of the milliarcsec. It's on the order of milliarcsecond. However, the angular resolution of the ground-based telescopes is in the order of arcsecond. The scene is for the ground-based telescope is in the order of arcsecond. So we can distinguish the images of the lensing like the cosmological scale, but we can see the magnification of the light of background star. So what we should do is that we look to the stars in the Milky Way or stars in the Large Magellanic Cloud, and then monitor the light flux and see the variation of their intensity as a function of time, and then we can, for some cases, we can see the gravitational lens. The other problem is that the probability of observing the microlensing, I'm going to use the microlensing term for this type of lensing. Microlensing, the probability is very low. It's a one event per 1 million star background star. So it's a very difficult experiment. And at the first time, Einstein in 1936, in the paper published in Nature, said that there's no chance for observing this phenomenon.
So this was published in Nature?
I think that was published in Nature.
So that's another evidence for why every paper in Nature is wrong.
So 50 years later, Pachinski in 1986 suggested the gravitational microlensing, this technique, for detecting compact halo astrophysical objects in the halo, because people thought that maybe the dark halo in the galactic, is made by stars, very low mass stars or black holes that don't shine. And so if we observe through the halo to the large and small Magellanic Cloud, LMC, and measure the number of the events, we can say that how many percent of the halo, dark halo, is made by this matrix. So in 1993, much of collaboration first observed the gravitational microlensing event, and later many groups as Eros, Ogle, Moa started observing the different directions. They observed the Large Magellanic Clouds, they observed the spiral arm, they observed the center of galaxy, and even they observed the M31, the nearby galaxy to the Milky Way. After 10 years, they published their results, and they put the constraint on the fraction of the halo made by matrix. The experiment finished here, but people use the gravitational microlensing for observing the extrasolar planets. This is a new technique for extrasolar planet observation. So what's happening in the microlensing? So I back again to the lensing. This is the lens plane, and this is our lens. This is the source star. When the source star passes through by the lens, in the lens plane, we will have two images here. And this is the Einstein ring, one inside Einstein ring and other is outside Einstein ring. Then we can show that the luminosity inside the surface doesn't change, but the area is extended. So that we will see the magnification of the background star. So the magnification or amplification is the sum of these two areas divided to the size of the source star. So we see that, so in the observation, we see that the brightness of star increases, reaches to a maximum value, maximum, and then comes back to the baseline. And the parameters parameters in the light curves, we have two parameters. T naught is the maximum time of the maximum magnification. TE is the Einstein crossing time. It's a time scale for the magnification of the light. And the U naught is the minimum impact parameter. Shows the height of this or the maximum magnification of the light curve. So we can show the probability of microlensing events. If we take a snapshot from the background star, we want to see how many percent or what's the probability of observing one microlensing event. So each microlensing, each star or each macros or star has a size of the Einstein ring here. And then if we sum the area covered by the Einstein ring and divide it to the old area, this gives us the probability of observing microlensing events. So it's very simple calculation. I don't go to the detail, but the result is if we do an order of magnitude calculation, that's the mass of the halo times g divided to d is the size of the halo divided to c squared. And this is in the order of 10 to minus 6. So the probability of observing microlensing event is 1 per million. If we observe in the direction of the large magnetic cloud. This is a sample of this is one of the examples of the microlensing event. This is the before, this is the background star before lensing, and this is the background star after the lensing. So you see that the lights change. If we look at the center of galaxy, the field is very crowded. So we see that here, for example, we have one lensing, that one star which is lensed. And after lensing, it gets dimmer, and sometimes it's so dim that it can't distinguish from the background. So sometimes you see that a star from the background just getting brighter and gets to reach the maximum, and then it goes to back in the order of 10 to I mean, in the order of 1 month. And I will say in the exoplanet part that the people are now observing the center of galaxy for the exoplanet detection, and each year they observe more than 1,000 microlensing events. So now it's very, it's not a rare event. So you can find 1,000 of the microlensing events each year. You can observe, I mean, towards the center of galaxy. This is the first microlensing candidate in 1993. So the people observe in the different filters because it's
like, can I ask you, they see like 1,000 microlensing events?
1,000 microlensing events each year.
What fraction of them are planets?
Among the 1,000, about 12 planets are detected by
microlensing.
So the planets are in the lens, are they modified lens patterns?
Sure. Yes, didn't they?
You still need this foreground lens to do it, which just modifies the structure.
So the people observe in a different filter because the gravitational microlensing is not sensitive to the color. So we should have the same magnification all the wavelength. So this is one of the criteria to distinguish the microlensing from the variable stars. And after 10 years of observation by the Eros and Macho collaboration, they put constraint on the fraction of halo made by macros. So this is the exclusion diagram for the experiment. And this is the fraction of the halo, and this is the mass of the macros. For instance, if we take the mass of macros 10 to minus 3 solar mass, it says that 95 level of confidence, it is 10% of the halo is made by the macros. Or if we take the mass function of the machos 10 to minus 5. So if we have a mass function for the machos, or we can say that it's less than 15%. So the conclusion is that we don't have enough machos in the galactic halo.
So what is the maximum mass that is allowed? Or is ruled out? It's 10 solar
it's mass? It's starting from sensitivity of the experiment, start from 10 to minus 7 to here.
10 solar.
But that means if everything was a stellar mass black hole out there, then at least the machos would be. Is that right?
Am I getting
that right? So if I had, if the machos were all 10 solar mass or 15 solar mass black holes, then that would be okay, right?
Okay. In fact, if you want to observe these masses, you should take very long time of the lens, because Einstein radius is very big and takes very long time for the transit. So you need a very long, 10 experiment to measure this masses.
So like 100 solar masses, the test is not quite ruled out, but anything above that, there are dynamical constraints.
This is observational constraint.
Yeah,
I
understand that.
So these longer
other constraints in addition to micro lensing that rule out 100 and above solar mass functions.
So this is a conclusion from these two experiments. It takes about 10 years, this experiment. So another application of the microlensing is exploring extrasolar planets. So I again come back to this lensing. Here, imagine that we have two lenses instead of one lens. One is a parent star, and other is the planet around the parent star. So if we calculate the Jacobian of the transformation, we can show that in some places, in some points on the lens plane, this Jacobian is zero. And this gives us a curve on the lens plane called the caustic curve. Means that if the source crosses this caustic curve, you will have infinite magnification. But we can show that in the gravitational lensing, the wave optic effects is dominating during the caustic crossing, and we don't have in reality a singularity here. We have very high magnification. So what's happening here is that we have very high magnification when the source crosses caustic. So we can see the critical line or something like this when you are swimming. If you look at the bottom of the pool, you will see that very shiny curves moving, and this is because when the wavefront passes the pool, changes the wavefront something like cone shapes here, and this gives us very high magnifications. We can see also some caustics here. If I put this glass here, you will see that some places you have some caustics. You have very high magnification here. Very similar to the case that we have for the binary systems. If we have a binary system here, we can see that in some places, if the light passes through some direction, you will have very high magnification here. So in this case, we have a standard lensing, but due to the presence of this planet here, we will have very high magnification when the source crosses caustic lines. So this is one of the samples of the microlensing events that is founded in 2005. And the advantage of the detecting extrasolar planets by microlensing is that you can detect very far planets from the parent star, beyond the snow line, which is not the case that for the transit or the Doppler effect methods. They are sensitive for the close by planets, but in the case of microlensing, you can see at the distance of Jupiter, planet at the distance of Jupiter from the parent star. So this is another example of the microlensing that MOA 2009, PhD 319. The strategy of observation is that there's two main surveys for the extrasolar planet, microlensing extrasolar planet. One is the Moore collaboration, and another is the Ogle collaboration. They have a very big field of view. They observe the center of galaxy, and when they see some anomaly in one of the microlensing, they alert it to the other collaborations, and they started to observe, to monitor the event with very high cadence. And you see that in this case, you have a lot of data point, and the model exactly fit with the data. And you can precisely get the parameters of the planet, and such as mass and distance to the parent star. So this is a now I'm going to talk about the Earth observation and towards the spiral arm. Earth observation started from in 1990-95 in first phase, and 1996-2003 in the second phase. And observations done by the 1 meter Marmi telescope at La Silla. They observed both large Magellanic and small Magellanic cloud, and also they had programmed to observe the center of galaxy and the spiral arms. In four directions, they observed the spiral arms. So this is, we are looking, sitting here, and then in four directions, they observed the spiral arm, beta scuti, gamma scuti, gamma norm, and theta muscular. So this is the frequency of observation, and this is the direction, exposure time, field of view, and the number of the background star. You see that, for example, beta, it is a few million star, 3 million star, 2 million star, so it's an order of the million of stars. In each direction, they observe a million of stars. So this is the overall, they found 22 microlensing events in the direction of spiral arm. This is the color magnitude of the background star, and the red dots are the microlensing events. So you see that microlensing events are in the color magnitude diagram, and I will show that's why some of these events, some of these dots, if we plot the distribution function, distribution of the stars, we see that microlensing events are a little bit in the red side. So that's I will show it a bit later. And also they found that the observation of optical depth toward each direction, and the number of events are 3, 10, 6, and 3. So this is a list of the 22 microlensing candidates in this spiral arm. If you look at the Einstein crossing time, you see that the Einstein crossing time is in the order of 100 days. And in some directions, the average Einstein crossing time is larger, and in some directions it's shorter. This is due to the structure of the Milky Way. So the structure of the Milky Way affects on the duration of microlensing events, number of the events, and also number of the background stars we are observing. Distribution of the color magnitude of the stars. So what I'm doing is what we have done is that to make a model for the Milky Way and compare the observation with the model. So here are the measurable parameters for this comparison. The first is the rate of event. How many events we are observing in each direction? In terms of background stars and the duration of our observation. So this is the detection efficiency for the observation. For each experiment, the particle physics and for the astronomy, you find the detection efficiency is a very important function. And it shows that how many percent of event with the relevant parameter of the physics, which here is Einstein crossing time, we can observe. For instance, if the efficiency function for 10 days Einstein crossing time is 0.1, means that we observe only 10% of the events. So if we observe one event, the real number of events is 10. So this gives us the real number of events that we are observing in an experiment. So if we have 22 events and we know the efficiency of detection efficiency for each event, we can obtain, we can calculate the real number of events, I mean, if we have 100% detection efficiency. So this gives the rate of the event that we can compare it with the model. Optical depth is a take a snapshot from the background star and say that how many percent of the ongoing microlens event we have. And also distribution of Einstein crossing time, color magnitude of the star, and average number of the stars in each field. These are the observable parameters in the, that we can compare with the model. So now modeling the microlens event. First, I start with the galactic model. So we put the matter in the spiral arm, in the disk, and the bulge, with the corresponding distribution function for the velocity of the particles, because velocity of particles is a relevant parameter here. If they move fast, the Einstein ring passes very fast, and we will have short duration event. It moves slowly, and then we will have long duration events. The stellar distribution of the stellar distribution in the Milky Way. This is important because if we have a bright star, the depth of our observation is larger, and we can see larger Einstein radius and long duration event, and more, and also we'll have more microlens event. If we have a faint star, then we will have less and short duration event. And the mass function of the lens also is important because larger mass gives us large Einstein radius. And the dust also is important because if we increase the dust and then our depth of observation will be shorter. So we should tune all these parameters and compare the model with the observation. So for the galactic disk, I took the standard double exponential for the disk. You can take from the Bede and Tremain group. And this is the double exponential for the matter distribution. And this is the dispersion velocity in three dimensions, three directions. For the bulge, also we take exponential model. And this is the Maxwell distribution for the velocity with 110 kilometers per second. For the excision and reddening, we imagine that the dust is the density of dust is proportional to the density of the hydrogen. So if we know the hydrogen density, we can get the extinction in two filter of B and R. For the stellar distribution, we can use the Hipparchus data. Hipparchus observed 118,000 stars around the sun. So from the parallax observation, we can see that it's observed up to a few hundred parsec. But we can make a complete sample of the stars around the by Hipparchus data. In fact, Hipparchus apparent visual magnitude, Hipparchus can observe all the stars up to 7.5 magnitude. So all the stars less than 7.5 magnitude is observed. 100% of these stars is observed by Hipparchus. Okay, so this is a criterion for to have a complete to make a complete set from this catalog. So this is the magnitude. I'm sorry, this is minus, this is plus. So this is minus, this is plus. So, and this is distance, and this is the this completion curve. For instance, if we go to 50 parsec, all the stars started from minus 6 magnitude to 4 magnitude are complete in this 50 parsec. We can see all the stars in this range in the 50 parsec. And for instance, if we want to see the, what is the completion distance for the 4 magnitude, 4 absolute magnitude, we can go here and this is 30 parsec. So for the magnitude, start with the magnitude, with the absolute magnitude of the 4, up to this 30 parsec, we can see all the stars here. So we can unbias this Hipparchus data. So I plot this, I took a cut up to 50 parsec because after 50 parsec, the distribution of stars is not homogeneous and we have bias. So if we cut the stars, distribution of stars up to 50 parsec, sorry, then we have all the stars distributed homogeneously. So this is the.
When was that? It wasn't completely homogeneous. There was a cluster or something.
Yeah, that's Hydrus.
Hydrus?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is one of the open cluster.
I didn't know.
Yeah. This one you said.
Yeah.
This is the open cluster here. So this is the color magnitude of the. Hipparchus catalog, and these are the bright stars, and we put the cut up to 50 parsec. All the black stars are complete up to 50 parsec, and then are complete. We can calculate their number density, but the greens, the red stars are incomplete up to, and we can get the completion distance and then calculate the number density of the stars. So this is the result in magnitude and color. The solid line is the distribution of the stars in magnitude and color, and in this dotted line is the distribution of stars complete up to 50 parsec. And if we unbias these stars, we get this distribution for the magnitude and this distribution for the color. So we can generate a complete color magnitude distribution of the stars around the solar system, and then in the next step we distribute it at the disk in the disk of the galaxy, put the dust there, and then observe through the dust through the disk, and measure all the parameters that we have in the observation, like the color magnitude, number of the microlensing event, their distribution, and then we can compare it with the observation. And this is the distribution of the color and magnitude after that we put them in the disk and then do the synthetic observation. So we generate the complete set of stars around the solar system according to the Hipparchus catalog, and then distribute it in the disk. But now we want to observe it through one telescope, like the 1 meter telescopes. So how many percent of the stars how many percent of these stars can be detected by this telescope, by this 1 meter telescope? So if we take this a field and come by 1 meter telescope and compare it with the Hubble Space Telescope, we can see that, for instance, these three stars are here. So all this bright star is observable in the Eros in 1 meter telescope. But some faint stars, or a fraction of faint star is observable here. For instance, here we have a bright star and a faint star just nearby to this. And it is in the grand 1 meter telescope. Using 1 meter telescope, they are blended, and we can distinguish this faint star. However, we have another, We have the same brightness here that we can see here. So only a fraction of this star is observed. So if we divide the population of the observed star in the one telescope, compared with the Hubble Space Telescope, we can get the acceptance efficiency or fraction of the stars that we can observe with a telescope, with a given telescope. This is a general technique for the detection probability in terms of the apparent magnitude. So if we use this detection efficiency and put the stars in the disk, synthesized star in the disk, and put the dust there, we can obtain the color magnitude of the stars for a given telescope. And this is the color magnitude distribution of stars for instance, for this 1 meter telescope. And then we can compare this color magnitude with the observations. We have the observation of the color magnitude in four directions. We can directly compare this one with this. This is simulated towards the gamma sensitivity. Gamma sensitivity is here's this one.
Do you have a model for a spiral arms as well?
For the arms, no, I didn't put the arms.
You just had the disc, the bulge.
Disc and bulge. And for the bulge also, I changed the orientation of the bar inside the bulge.
Ah, so it's the bar, not the...
Yeah.
Okay.
But not for the spiral arms. That makes
the problem complicated. So your bulge, is it like an ellipsoid? Or
yeah, it's an ellipsoid.
And it has some preferred axis.
No, it has it's ellipsoid with a three axis,
okay.
And then we can rotate it with respect to our line of sight to the bulge. Oh. So. One of the questions that we ask is that why most of the microlens stars are redder than the background stars. So we can see that we have some red stars. The population of red stars at this part of color magnitude diagram is more than the Fock distribution of the stars at the background. If we make a histogram from there in terms of the color, we see that the distribution is not the same. We have more distribution of the observed microlensing star compared to background star. And we can show this in the simulation. If we run the simulation, we can show that this is the distribution of the microlens stars, and this is the distribution of the observed stars in the field. And we see that the distribution of the microlens star is much redder because the red stars are brighter and they are located at the far distance from the observer, and then the probability of the observing the for the distant star is more than close star. So that's why we see the more bright red stars here in the color magnitude diagram. And also we can compare the optical depth toward the fourth direction. And if we put the disk model and also bulge, if there's no orientation of the bulge, we will have a symmetric distribution for the bulge for the optical depth. But this asymmetry comes from the orientation of the bulge.
So just a quick question. Those red stars, you said they're brighter, so you mean that these are HEB stars?
We can see it.
If they were K or M stars, they might be redder, but they surely would be dimmer then, right?
We have here, we have this star. This may come from here, because it's located at the farthest distance from the source. We have the redening and the extinction. So we have this star, the original point of position of the star might be here.
Sure. So then what kinds of stars are these?
I can't remember, I should go into detail. It's a good question.
So if they're farther, they could be redder because they're a red giant, or they could be redder because they're reddened by the dust. So there are two ways of reddening.
It gets dimmer and redder because of extinction and reddening. So we don't know exactly where is their original position in the color map. Right? And also for the lens, you can take the mass function for the lens of the stars and then put the coordinates for the lens. And finally, we can do chi-square fitting to all the distributions that we have. Einstein crossing time in the four direction, optical depth in four direction, distribution of the color, distribution of magnitude, number density of stars. For all distribution, we can do a chi-square fitting. And they minimize the fitting in terms of the angular orientation of the bar, fraction of hydrogen in the disk, and the population of the red giants in the central, in the bulge, because it's also sensitive.
What is the fraction of hydrogen important for?
It's for the extinction.
So that's dust.
Yes, that's dust.
So why do you say hydrogen?
Because the hydrogen is density is proportional to dust density. So if you get there is a direct relation. I mean, you could find the relation between the hydrogen and the extinction. So this is the result. I just plot one of the parameters, the hydrogen fraction of the disk, and this is the overall chi-square fitting. You see that we have a minimum chi-square around 0.6. 6% of the hydrogen disk is made by the hydrogen. This is one.
So sorry, this is neutral hydrogen, right? Or not?
Yes, I see. And also for the orientation of the bar, the 45% with respect to our line of sight is the best fit to the oldest observed parameters. I didn't put here the population of the red giant because there's big uncertainty there. So. And it's better to work a little bit more on this point. Okay, I finished.
Right, so the reason why I was asking about what kinds of stars they are is because AGB stars have masers, and so do O and B stars. So those are amenable to BLBA. And so if you were saying that milliarc second scale is the size of the images, you could imagine using the BLBA to
VIBA?
Yeah, very long baseline array.
Okay.
So radio observations to actually make images of the stars. But that's only if, you know, there are these very massive or late type stars that produce radio emissions. So that might be interesting if you're getting thousands a year. Some fraction of those have to be really bright stars or older stars, AGB stars. Mm-hmm. And if you have a month head lead time, you know, they can get on that quick. Make a picture of the thing. And what degeneracies would that lift for you? Would it actually make any difference if you guys had a resolved image of the multiple lenses? Would this be useful besides a bundle
for thing the multiple? You mean that we observe directly the images of the lens? Okay, you can do it also with the. Space-based interferometry telescopes. C was the project, I think it's I don't know what's the destination of this. Space interferometry mission.
That's the one that didn't happen.
And Gaia also, there's another project.
You don't need to go to space. I mean, if you want to do this in optical wavelengths and stuff, there are all kinds of other problems. But if there is radio emission, you can do this from the ground.
Okay.
Cellular techniques that have been used for 50 years now. But what would you get from that?
I don't know that if the radio emission is enough.
Well, I mean, I know they do see, from at least the galactic center, they see lasers in massive stars.
So, okay.
I mean, and then they can see these around the galaxy. So whether or not it's bright enough in the open season. But what would you gain if I were to say somehow I made an image of the lensing event? So now, in addition to having the amplification, you have a picture, and you,
okay,
can make a little, you can make a movie just like you did with the,
yeah,
point. What would you be able to say
about this
with that?
Okay, in the case of single lens, that's what we studied. We have degeneracy in the parameters. One observable parameter is the Einstein crossing time. The Einstein crossing time is the ratio of the Einstein radius to the transverse velocity. So Einstein radius is also depends on the mass of lens and distance of the lens from the observer. So we have degeneracy. If you can do astrometry of the microlens, you can break the degeneracy.
Maybe instead of the degeneracy between three parameters, you still have the mass distance degeneracy, but you remove the velocity degeneracy.
We know that what's the velocity, because if we see the images, we can see what's the velocity, relative velocity. So you are directly observing the images, so you measure the velocity.
Yeah.
So you are measuring velocity and also this separation of the images. Then I think
but you don't get anything from the structure of the images.
Structure of the,
yeah, no, I don't know where exactly at the position, so
yeah,
look at the images here,
okay,
in details. I don't know if it gives you some information or,
one application is I can
publish
in Nature.
No, but I don't know.
But it's not a theory paper.
I should remember some formula, because I think you can break all the things if you do the astrometry.
Has anyone done this?
No, because the problem is the observation. In theory, yes, you could
not. No, okay.
But he's got the observation at that point.
I mean, this isn't even the fancy. You don't even have to do fancy stuff. The POBA is a dedicated instrument for doing tenth of a milliard second resolution imaging of radio sources. And they need things to do. if there is a significant fraction, so if they had a couple things here to look at, and you could give them enough lead time, say a few days,
so
they can go look at that.
The direction of the bulge there, each season we have a thousand events.
The fraction of those that are massive stars. So the source star.
Source star may be not bright red stars. I haven't done simulation in the center of the galaxy, but I think it would be the same. You are sensitive to the red bright stars.
Amplification do you need to trigger?
Depends on our definition from the trigger.
So I'm asking about a more diffuse object, something that's not one mass. It would still give you a photometric signal, but it won't spike the way that a matcha does. So if it's more of a diffuse, I guess there's a density there with impact parameter as well. But how much magnification, just typically, roughly speaking, do you need to even trigger? 6%,
5%? If the source cross the Einstein ring, its magnification is 1.34.
Mm-hmm.
But the trigger depends on the strategy, because if you define a trigger for the event, then you obtain the acceptance or efficiency functions, everything. So if you put, for example, for some experiments, you can say that, okay, I took the microlensing event, if the impact parameter be less than 0.7 Einstein rate, I took this event as a microlensing event, and then you get the optical that everything. It is compatible with the, if we take a 1 Einstein ratings. But in this case, you will have less event compared to the bigger, I mean, loose criteria. So normally, if you have a 3 consecutive data point, 3 sigma above the baseline, you say that something is going. Yeah.
So in terms of a percentage magnification, what is that? If I say I have a population of objects that are diffuse, so that even with 0 impact parameter, the most magnification you could ever hope would be maybe 5%, 10%, not the spike. Would you be able to see those, or would those just fall from your threshold? Where how much magnification do you need at peak to even trigger to say that we've got something here?
Yeah, I said it depends on the experiment. I mean,
So how much is 1 sigma? Like one, is it like 10% magnification? Is 1 sigma?
Yeah, what's your photometric precision? Is
what I mean.
How much magnification do you reliably measure?
For each data point, you can get the error bar, and then. Normally, if you have a couple of, if you have, for example, 3 data points, yeah, we start here. This is the magnitude, and then you have this data point here, and then you see that if for instance, 3 data points above 3 sigma, then you trigger that something is. Then
so
you focus in the.
What's your sigma?
Sigma is the error bar here.
No, but
I don't think we can answer that first, but it depends on the star.
Depends on the star. For the bright star, we have less error bar. I for the phase, it's a combination of systematic and Poisson.
There is to distinguish microlensing from some other variability.
Mm-hmm.
It starts to shape.
I'm just looking for a ballpark.
So
10%, 50%? But for you to see a microlensing, is it twice as bright? Does it have to be 10%?
I think the graph that you showed is only like 10 sigma instead of
in fact,
now,
what people have done, what people are doing is that this two survey observe the background stars. Look at the brightness of the star. If they see, there is a criterion there. So if they see, for example, 3 data point above the 3 sigma, then they fit the microlensing light curve to this, and then they follow this. If it's the fit fine, they alert it as a microlensing.
Okay.
So other groups started to observe this. But there is a automatic machine code for this. It's in the University of San Andreas. Martin Dominic is responsible for this. And then all data goes from to this, and then.
Does that mean that they miss microlensing events which aren't caused by a point source?
Sorry?
Does that mean that they miss microlensing events that aren't consistent with the point source? If the way that they trigger on it is that they take the first few data points and predict where it ought to be, if it lands there and they decide it's an event, then they beg the question, right? Said, here's something that's a microlensing effect that it looks like what we think a microlensing event should look like, as opposed to saying, here's a flaring event, which is interesting, and maybe it's a microlensing event. So,
yeah.
I mean, do they just throw away the, I mean, are there lots of events where things get 10 sigma brighter that just wouldn't fit the point source?
You know, exactly the detail.
Yeah, I think so. sources could be vertical, right?
You can discard the value and start that.
So, to shape, then it's pretty hard to know.
Well, then you could do it in multiple ways.
There's also, yes, yeah. Normally people observe it in a couple, two, at least in a two way thing. And you can discard if the variant starts. But if the fit is fine, you go further and take one more data if it's fine. And there is a strategy for this observation. And then if few data points gets bet as a good right in the right position, you say okay, it's so. But I don't know the detail.
So you don't have a picture of the galaxy for us, because you measure these parameters. It's important to have a picture.
Right? Okay. Oh, yeah, I have it here. Sorry, I showed it. So this is the picture of galaxy.
So that's a good question, right? So the machos are supposed to be these halo objects, but you're looking specifically through what looks like this.
The stars here. The stars are.
Okay. Some questions. Let's wrap it up.